to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
Nearly 1 year ago, the Maryland Supreme Court agreed to hear the case of Moses African Cemetery. Today, we have the results of the court decision. We will talk to the lead attorney, Steve Lieberman, who argued the case. Chairman O'Malley, Yesitela, and the Uhuru III just won an historic victory against the FBI. But the fight is not over. Let's talk about how you can help. Stay tuned. Good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm your host, Dr. Marcia Adebayo, and I'm with you the fourth Wednesday of each month. 1 year ago on this show, we announced that the Maryland Supreme Court had decided to hear the case involving the desecration of Moses African Cemetery in Bethesda, Maryland. This is a case brought against the Montgomery County Housing Opportunities Commission, HOC. Attorney Steve Lieberman, a partner in the law firm of Rothwell and Figg, argued the case before the Maryland Supreme Court that was filled with community and WPFW supporters. This morning, we will discuss what the Maryland Supreme Court decided and where we go from here. Good morning, Attorney Lieberman.
Good morning, Marcia. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. If it's okay with you, I'd like to start today with a short bio of your professional accomplishments. We've had you on the show a number of times, and yet I've never truly sort of introduced you in terms of your background to our listeners. You have been called by Chambers USA the best strategic thinker and one of the best lawyers in DC in any practice. You are a litigator and counselor whose private law practice encompasses the spectrum of intellectual property law, from patent litigation, especially in the pharmaceutical medical area, to e-commerce, privacy, and post-grant proceedings. You have successfully represented a wide range of clients from the very large pharmaceutical companies, as well as such notable companies as the New York Times, to startups and small community organizations, such as the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition. You are an accomplished First Amendment litigator with a strong devotion to issues of constitutional law and religious liberties. Again, Steve, thank you so much for appearing on What's at Stake.
Thank you, Marcia. I'm almost embarrassed hearing that description, but it would make my mother happy to hear it.
So, it would make any mother happy to hear this. So allow me, if you would, to summarize the history of the Moses Cemetery, and then if you could summarize the legal journey of the cemetery. So let's start at the beginning of this story for those who've not heard about this historic struggle to stop the desecration of Moses Cemetery. Most people are surprised to learn that Bethesda, Maryland, one of the wealthiest communities in the world, was the site of four large plantations that BACC calls appropriately death camps, where hundreds, perhaps thousands of kidnapped Africans were murdered in order to enrich tobacco barons. Little girls were raped on a commercial level and forced to bear children to provide the future labor force for the Deep South from the mid-1700s to 1864. After emancipation, a vibrant Maroon community developed and thrived until a plan was developed by Montgomery County federal officials, the police force, developers, and the KKK to destroy the community on River Road. The plan was called Scatter the Negroes. The goal of the plan was to confiscate the hard-earned land of these formerly enslaved people. Through unrelenting terror, the plan was successful. And by 1960s, not a single Black household existed on River Road. The cemetery with hundreds of bodies underneath, near the Westwood Towers apartment building, was made into a parking lot until BACC and your law firm started to protest and litigate. The cover-up had been successful. So that's a very brief history of the struggle that's before us. Could you now summarize the legal journey from the court, from the circuit court to the Maryland Supreme Court?
Sure. So, Marcia, as you pointed out, there were four plantations in the Bethesda area before the Civil War. And after emancipation, after the Civil War, there was a vibrant African-American community in the area. And as with every community, their members lived and they died. And when the members of that community died, many of them were buried in the Moses African Cemetery, which is in an area just west of River Road in Bethesda. If people are driving along River Road, when they get to the McDonald's, if they look to their left, if they're going to the north or the west, they'll see the Westwood Towers apartment building. And that's owned by HSC. And adjoining the apartment building is the parking lot for the apartment building. When the apartment building was constructed in the late 1960s, the land that was destined for the parking lot had somewhere between 200 and 300 or 400 bodies buried in the land. There were grave markers, there were headstones. But in the course of the construction, without getting appropriate permission, the people who were developing that property bulldozed the gravestones. They eliminated all traces, all surface traces of the burial ground. And during the construction of the parking lot, from time to time, according to eyewitness testimony, bodies or body parts would make their way to the surface, would be uncovered. And when that happened, a bell was rung, construction would be stopped. Somebody would come over and take the body or the body part that had been discovered, put it in the back of a pickup truck, and it would disappear. With no record of what happened to it. And after that happened a few times, it was decided by the people developing the property to simply encase the burial ground in asphalt and to do it in such a way so that the inconvenience of the bodies did not stop future construction. And so the burial ground was paved over as a parking lot in the late 1960s, and it's remained as a parking lot until this very day. And the owner, the Montgomery County Housing Opportunities Commission, continues to allow the residents of the Westwood Towers apartment building to park on top of these bodies. Even though it's known now for many years what's underneath the parking lot, they've done nothing to change the use of the parking lot. So several years ago, when you, Marcia, and other members of the BACC and the Macedonia Baptist Church and its leader, the Reverend Adebayo, learned about an imminent sale of the property to a developer. We brought suit on behalf of the BACC, the church, and three descendants of people buried underneath the parking lot to enjoin the sale under a really never-before-used statute. When I say never before used for this precise purpose. And we argued that the statute required the owner of a property that had a burial ground on it, even if the burial ground wasn't active, to go into court and get permission from a court of equity before it could sell a property. And the court could impose certain conditions on the sale, like you had to relocate the bodies, you had to memorialize them, you had to treat them properly, you had to make sure that they weren't disturbed, that sort of thing. And we received a very courageous ruling from Judge Carlos Smith of the Montgomery County Superior Court, enjoining the sale of the property and saying that if HOC wanted to sell the property to a developer, it had to go into court and get permission, which it didn't want to do because it wouldn't get such permission from a court, not without massive requirements to remedy this ongoing desecration. Case went up to the Maryland Intermediate Appellate Court, and that court reversed, and a what I would say was a narrow technical ruling having to do with the language of the statute and saying it really wasn't designed for this purpose. It was designed to give property owners a mechanism for providing clear title to purchasers against future claims by the descendants of people who were buried on the property. So we took the case to the Supreme Court of Maryland, which only hears about 10 or 12% of the appeals that are filed. And it decided to hear this case. And it was argued, as you pointed out, last January to a packed courtroom. And the court obviously saw that this was a very, very important issue. And the court made clear that it was going to hear the two arguments we put in our briefs. One was the statutory argument, but one was a broader argument, which is that under sort of little enforced provisions of Maryland law, you know, a long history going back hundreds of years, there's a common law obligation of property owners to treat the bodies of people who have been buried with dignity and respect. And that if they don't do that, they can be subject to claims, legal claims. So the Maryland Supreme Court heard the argument, and it was clear from the argument that there was a lot of dissent within and among the members of the court. And, you know, you sort of guess as a lawyer what the judges are, what the justices are thinking by the questions I asked. But here, you know, what happened was the court was not able to issue a ruling until the very last day of the term. And on the very last day of the term, on August 30th, they issued the ruling, and there were, in fact, three dissents from the ruling. There were seven members of the Supreme Court who were three dissents. What the majority said is that the statute couldn't be used for the purpose that we had sought to use it for. But the majority also said that it was recognizing clearly and with the voice of the Supreme Court of Maryland that under Maryland law, there is an obligation to treat bodies with dignity and respect. And if you don't do that, then people who have an interest in that property, descendants, relatives, people with a cultural or community interest in the property, can bring a lawsuit against the property owner for injunctive relief so that the property is treated in a manner that's appropriate for a burial ground and perhaps also for damages. And the court specifically gave us the permission to go back to the trial court to amend our complaint and seek that relief. And we are in the process of doing that now. We're in the process of preparing the papers. And the plan is to file that amended complaint shortly. And among other things, what we're going to be asking the court to do is to order the Montgomery County Housing Opportunities Commission to stop allowing cars to park on top of that burial ground. And we're going to be asking them to remove the parking lot. And we're going to be asking them to respect the wishes of the relatives and the descendants of the people buried there and to properly memorialize that burial ground and to treat the graves with dignity and respect. So it was really, you know, in the short term, there was some disappointment with the Supreme Court's ruling, but it opened a door. It opened the door wide open. It's not going to be an easy path. But the court has given us guidelines as to how to proceed. And the court has said Maryland law allows this type of lawsuit. And so we're going to be filing that proceeding, you know, in the coming weeks.
Thank you so much. And you're right. We are incredibly excited about the filing of a new lawsuit against what we consider criminal activity against our ancestors. I just wanted to give our audience a small sample of the language of the Maryland Supreme Court. This is the same court that decided the Dred Scott decision in 1857. But this is what they said in 2024. This case concerns a desecrated burial ground in Maryland, Montgomery County. The ground, sometimes known as Moses Cemetery, was a historic Black burial place that contained interments of many individuals, including formerly enslaved persons and their families. After burials ceased in the mid-20th century, The land was sold and eventually developed into an apartment complex and parking lot in the late 1960s. The record suggests that rather than respectfully disinterring and moving the remains of the deceased, the developers disturbed the ground, removed human remains haphazardly and inconsistently, destroyed grave markers, and ultimately paved a portion of the land into a parking lot. It appears likely that human remains are still interred in the land today, which is currently part of a property known as the Westwood Towers Apartments. Steve, this is very strong language coming from the Maryland Supreme Court. How do you explain that the court also ruled that HOC, the Housing Opportunities Commission, could sell the land and the bodies underneath the soil?
Right. So the court dealt with a very complex and confusing area of the law. And the court made very clear that under the law, there's no restriction on the sale of a property just because the property is a burial ground. What there is there are legal and equitable restrictions on how you treat those bodies and how you treat the land. And that's what we need to focus on a going forward basis. No matter who buys that property, the Maryland Supreme Court was very clear about this. The owners of the property are going to be subject to legal and equitable claims with respect to the treatment of the human remains on that site. So here's what the court said. The court said, to put a finer point on it, if a seller of a qualifying burial ground sells such property without obtaining a judgment under this statute, interested parties remain able to bring not only legal claims, but also their equitable claims in the circuit courts. And perhaps more to the point here, interested parties need not wait for the burial ground to be the subject of a contract for sale to seek equitable relief in connection with the alleged desecration of the burial ground. The descendants of people who were laid to rest in burial grounds where deeds were not executed and certificates not issued may seek equitable relief under the common law of burial places. So the court said, you can sell the property, but current owners and future owners are going to be subject to these claims. Everybody has to respect the rights that are attendant upon these circumstances, meaning the people who have died and who have been buried are the weakest members of our society. And our society owes them an obligation to treat their remains appropriately and with dignity and with respect. And the court has now put some teeth in that. It's not just a moral idea floating out there. The court has said there is a legal way to compel people to treat these weakest members of our society, those who are dead and who can do nothing to protect themselves, to treat their remains properly. So that's what we're going to do.
Right. Now, so what you're saying, just in terms of translating this into very common language, what you're saying is that anyone who now purchases a Black burial ground, at least in the state of Maryland, and maybe you can tell us whether this has national implications, is now facing basically what we used to call a toxic purchase. In other words, you can buy it, but if you buy it, you should also expect, or you can expect, that people now have the right to sue you in the court of equity for the desecration of a burial ground. So now the purchase is tainted in a sense, because if you buy a Black burial ground, now you can expect that the descendants have a right to sue you. Is that correct?
Yeah. I'd make two modifications. First, it applies not just to Black burial grounds, but to all burial grounds.
Okay.
Black, Native American, white. The point is that our society owes an obligation to people who have passed away for their remains to be treated appropriately. And that obligation rests on purchases of properties too. So if somebody's thinking about purchasing a property with an abandoned burial ground on it, thinking that they can build an apartment building on it, or just willy-nilly put a highway on top of it or some other sort of building, they need to think twice, because they're.
And now the Washington Post editorial board has now called upon Montgomery County, in essence, to stop the desecration and to center the decision-making about what happens in the future of Moses Cemetery in the hands of the descendant community. What was your reaction to the Washington Post editorial?
Well, it's one of their few editorials that I actually agreed with. I agreed with it wholeheartedly. They're exactly right here. This is a very, very important issue, and it affects all of us. I mean, nobody wants their grandmother or their grandfather, their grave to be, to be parked on top of. Nobody wants their grave to, their ancestors' graves to be treated as a, as a dog park, as an athletic facility. And this is particularly important because adjoining the parking lot for Westwood Towers is another property that was also part of the Moses African Cemetery, which is owned by the Montgomery County Parks and Planning Commission. Mm-hmm. And they have plans to make that land into a park, a recreational area where people are going to be able to hike, walk their dogs, jog, exercise. And while a park certainly sounds better than a parking lot, I don't think anybody would want people walking their dogs or even jogging on top of grandma and grandpa. And so this ruling is going to apply to them as well. So you had asked earlier, does this ruling apply outside the state of Maryland? The answer is no and yes. No in the strictly legal sense that it doesn't bind the courts of any other state. Yes in the sense that other courts in other states are going to look to this ruling for guidance. And hopefully they'll follow the ruling of the Maryland Supreme Court on these issues and will say that the law in other states is similar. So this ruling, I think, could be a bellwether and could shape the way African-American burial grounds are treated throughout the United States.
Another issue is that the court also requested more guidance from the Maryland State Assembly, indeed other legislative bodies on this problem. I'm hoping that Congressman Jamie Raskin is listening to this program, since Moses Cemetery is located in his district. What kind of legislation do you think is needed from these bodies, whether it's at the State Assembly level or the U.S. Congress, to prevent what happened or what's happening across the country, I should say, to Black burial grounds? What kind of legislation do you think would be helpful at this point?
Right. Well, first on the state level, the state legislature has the ability and has the power to promulgate laws which regulate and impose very specific obligations on property owners. The state legislature could put in place, for example, a statute which said before you sell a property with a burial ground, you have to do this. We had hoped that the court would interpret the very old statute to impose that obligation. The court said no, but the Maryland Assembly can fix that problem. They can pass a new statute. In terms of the federal government, the federal government, the Congress has passed a statute having to do with Native American burial grounds. It doesn't apply to African American burial grounds, but Congress should consider whether or not a similar statute might be appropriate with respect to African American burial grounds. But I think the first place to start is with the Maryland legislature, and hopefully Governor Moore will get behind this and urge the legislature to come up with an appropriate statute that will provide an additional layer of protection for African American and other abandoned or disused burial grounds. So I would say that's the first step.
And have you heard from Governor Moore or Congressman Raskin or any other elected official in Montgomery County in terms of congratulating you on this incredible historic win or requesting information about how they can assist going forward with this issue?
Not yet, but my email address is pretty well publicized, so if they want to reach out, it won't be hard to find me.
Okay, we only have a few seconds left, but what are the next steps? And what can the WPFW community do to help?
Well, the next step is we're going to be filing a motion for leave to file an amended complaint. And then we're going to be seeking injunctive relief once the motion for leave to file the amended complaint is granted. And what this community can do is to put pressure on its elected representatives in the Maryland legislature to enact a statute that will give even more teeth to these sorts of claims. We all have the obligation to protect the weakest members of our society. There's no group that needs protection more ardently than the people who have passed on. We have the obligation to those members of our community. So I'd ask everybody to reach out to your legislator and say, please do something. And as you know, we're in contact with a number of individuals about what kind of statute might be helpful. Mm-hmm. But pressure to support this effort is very important.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. We appreciate you. We appreciate your dedication to truth telling and fighting for those who can no longer speak for themselves. And we look forward to having you back very soon to update our community on the progress of the lawsuit. So thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you, Marcia. Take care.
Thank you. We'll take a short break for community announcements.
Hi, this is Miyuki Williams.
And I'm Robin Holden. This is Reggae Music and the Reggae Experience present a WPFW fundraising concert featuring Image Band, Curlew Reggae All-Stars Band, Lady Flame, and Carl Malcolm.
On Saturday, October 5th, 7 p.m. until midnight at King Solomon Lodge, 2245 Rhode Island Avenue, Northeast.
Tickets available at Eventbrite by searching WPFW.
All proceeds to benefit WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. This is Marcia Adebayo, your host every fourth Wednesday. Our next guest is Chairman Omali Yesitela, who is the chair of the African People's Socialist Party. Good morning, Chairman Omali, and welcome to What's at Stake.
Good morning. Thank you so very much for having me on today, Sister Marcia. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, before we discuss what happened on July 29th, 2022, again, allow me to provide a brief bio. Chairman Omali Yesitela is a Pan-Africanist, socialist, and activist born in St. Petersburg, Florida. He served in the Army from 1959 to 1963, where he first publicly critiqued U.S. imperialism and challenged racism. In 1966, Chairman Yesitela established the St. Petersburg Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. His controversial arrest by the SPP during one of the protests led to the US Supreme Court ruling of Waller versus Florida in 1970 that decreed no two courts can try someone for the same crime, double jeopardy. Nevertheless, he served 2 years in prison and could not vote until his 2000th clemency. In 1972, Chairman Omali formed the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement and the African People's Socialist Party, which 3 years later successfully fought for the 1975 release of Florida death row inmates Wilbur Lee and Freddie Pitts. Chairman Omali has authored 13 books, including The Road to Socialism is Painted Black in 1987. So Chairman Omali, thank you. Thank you, thank you so much for your unwavering commitment and for your lifetime commitment to Black people and to the Pan-African community. Now, on July 29th, 2022, your house was bombed by the FBI, the federal government, using flashbang grenades, guns drawn, drones deployed. Your neighborhood was turned into a war zone. Seven offices of the African People's Socialist Party and Uhuru Movement were under attack. The seven offices of SPSP and the Uhuru Movement, your home in St. Louis, the Uhuru House in St. Pete, and the Uhuru Solidarity Center in St. Louis were attacked. And this was a coordinated military attack by the US government. You were charged with, and please help me if I misstate this, with acting as an agent for the Russian government and conspiracy to impact American elections for a foreign government. There were also white solidarity workers who were attacked, Jesse Neville and Penny Hess, thus the name Uhuru 3. Why do you, did I get this history correct?
More or less, it's pretty good.
Well, okay, well, I don't wanna be pretty good, I wanna be perfect. So explain to us what happened and fill in the pieces that I missed.
Well, I think it's really important for everyone to understand that this coordinated attack, military style attack that was made against us, it was made, as you mentioned, my home in St. Louis, Missouri, where my wife and I were both threatened, where our next door neighbors had their doorbell videos taped over so no one could see what the FBI was doing, where the FBI occupied their front porch. And as you mentioned, they occupied an entire community, coordinated off in St. Petersburg, Florida. They actually required people who were going to and from their houses to show identification. So it was a massive assault. It was an assault on an entire community. And it was done, as they say, as we were to learn later, because they had they wanted to serve a search warrant. And it seemed to me like you can knock on the door if you really wanted to serve a search warrant. And that the search warrant was something that was occurring, they said, because later on that day, an indictment was coming down later that morning against us, a Russian national who was in Russia, and that my name was attached to that. And that that was the basis for them making this assault. They handcuffed, they zip tied me behind my back. They handcuffed my wife when she finally was able to get downstairs as well behind her back. And they held us at gunpoint, without telling us that we could leave if we wanted to, because they arrested no one. With all of this, no one was arrested. And they did a similar thing, as you mentioned, at the Solidarity Center in St. Louis, which was on the south side, where majority of the white people live in St. Louis. They attacked our center there. They attacked the living spaces. There was an apartment above the Solidarity Center in St. Louis, occupied by Jesse Neville and a woman who would become his wife, Amanda Carlosi. They attacked them. They held them at gunpoint. They went to the home of Penny Hess, that she lived with a housemate, Kitty Riley. They held them at gunpoint. They occupied these spaces for 7 and 8 hours, taking all kinds of resources and materials, my home. They took cell phones, laptops, iPads, anything that could be used for communication. They took all of these materials, they stole it. And then we were considered unindicted co-conspirators with Russia. That's what we were, with the Russian nationals. We were unindicted co-conspirators, and there was one other Russian who at that time we were aware of, who was characterized as an unindicted co-conspirator, though he was in Russia, and there was not likely that he was ever going to see a jail or an FBI attack on his home there. And so we lived in a kind of state of purgatory for a period of 9 months. 9 months, it took them 9 months before they even indicted us. And I'm convinced today that one of the reasons, there are a couple of reasons. One, they never had any basis. There was nothing. It was a political attack, and it was a political crime that they committed us of having committed. And they knew there was nothing, no evidence to support this thing, despite the fact that they took the equivalent of 2.5 million books with the so-called 13 terabytes of information they took from us altogether. They knew there was nothing. They had nothing to support this claim. But the FBI brags about having a record of something like 96, 97% conviction rate. And they have this 96, 97% conviction rate in part because most people simply collapse and say, make some kind of plea deal to plead guilty to something so they don't have to feel the full weight of the federal government. This is the government that's sending battleships in the Mediterranean and killing people all over Ukraine and everything else. And to go against this entity, you know, is something that can be seen as really formidable. And so most people simply make some kind of plea deal with them, but we didn't. Because we were not guilty of anything, and also because we saw the attack as being extraordinarily insidious for the implications that it had on our people. I think they took such a long time to indict also because they hoped that we would run or that we would do something else that would give legitimacy to an attack on us based on speech. They were attacking us based on what they said we said, elections that we participated in, things like this. So to undermine the illegitimacy of this attack on us, they were trying to pressure us, we believe, into doing something that would give them a genuine legal basis for that. And we didn't do any of that. And what we did instead was we came to this show and we came to the people. And because we believe the power is in the people and that there was so much at stake that it's extremely important for everybody to understand with this attack that was made on us. In fact, we said this is the canary in the coal mine. This attack on us is something that's going to be leading. You'll see more attacks throughout. And we have seen attacks across the political spectrum subsequent to the attack that was made on us. So that's part of what happened. And then we finally were indicted some 9 months later and in Tampa, Florida, the middle district of Tampa, Florida, where I had to go. And I was subjected to mug shots and fingerprinting and placed in leg irons and put in a cell and handcuffed, as was Penny Hess. And then later, Jesse Neville faced the same kind of thing. And then paraded out into a courtroom where, you know, we had to plead not guilty to being agents of Russia and involved in some kind of conspiracy with Russians against the United States government. And then we just went to trial, as you know, on September 3rd, and which was an extraordinary kind of event, you know, for its own reasons and what have you. And it was really important. It was important in general terms, in terms of the issue of free speech. It was across the political spectrum. It was important for that question, free speech, the freedom to criticize the United States government, the freedom to advocate in the interests of whatever one wanted to, based on what was characterized as the Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, association, this kind of stuff. It was a very important thing across the board. But it's especially important for Black people because what they have done is attempt to criminalize advocating for the liberation, for the freedom of Black people here and around the world. They wanted to make that a crime without characterizing it as a crime. And so the thing that they would do is charge us with working for Russians. So if we say that Black people should be paid reparations for the crimes committed against us, they contrive something and actually said in the court that the Russians are the ones who came up with the reparations demand. If we say that the United States government should be responsive to the 1948 Convention on United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, they say that it's the Russians who told us to do this. And in fact, they said the Russians came up with it. If we say that we will use the electoral process, which is they say is the legitimate process of seeking change in this country, as opposed to attacking the Capitol and defecating on the floors and chasing the vice president down the hallway, threatening to hang him. If we say we're going to use the electoral process, they say it's the Russians who paid us to do this, et cetera. So they would negate those things which are characterized as democratic rights generally and normally when they are speaking about the majority of the people in this country. For Black people to make those criticisms and to make those efforts, it's a criminal act because it's not legitimate. We are not legitimate. The Russians are the forces that are responsible. And this feeds into, you know, something going back to the 50s. I've seen where books were written talking about, you know, how the Russian communists would take advantage of the ignorant people in Africa to lead us to these ways, you know, our simple-minded Black people. And so now we are simple-minded Black people who don't have consciousness, who don't have agency of our own, who don't know what it is that's happening to us, who don't know that we should have a responsibility to fight for a future for our own children. The Russians told us to do this. And this was what's so really important. This is why the inability of the prosecution, the state, to win that jury, to saying that we were employees of Russia, that was important. The fact that the jury said not guilty on this case, on this instance, was really important. Not just because it carried maximum sentence of 10 years versus the 5 years for conspiracy, but because to convict us on that is to convict Black people, is to say that we have no legitimacy. We cannot make criticism. Any criticism we make of the government as Black people is something that's subject to suspicion because some other force is responsible for it. It is a way of the United States government absolving itself of all the crimes committed every day, every minute against Black people in this country that's responsible for the conditions of existence that we are confronting with on a daily basis. So that's part of what they wanted to do. We beat them back on that. They were not able to convince that jury of just ordinary white people. There were a couple of Latinos, there was an Asian, et cetera there. But we were able to beat them back on that.
It's an extraordinary story. It's an extraordinary story. And I really hope that people hear about or just are taken into consideration the kind of fight back you put into this struggle. To fight back the United States government. I mean, you fought back when so many people have decided this government is too big, too violent, too, you know, extraordinary for me to fight. So let me just take a plea deal and go to prison for 10 years and then try to restart. But you didn't do that. And for those of us in the community who saw the fight that you put up, it's extraordinary. And it's so important because, as you know, these attacks are targeted not only against political organizations, but also media outlets, such as the African Stream, a Pan-African media outlet, which was recently targeted and censored by the US government, and social media corporations such as Meta, and other groups that you know other Black groups that have dared to question and to fight back against the U.S. government. I don't want the conversation to get lost around what you accomplished and what the court decided or what the jury decided. So could you just sort of step back for what did the jury decide in this case?
The jury decided that we did not work for the Russians. We do not work for the Russians. That, which is an extraordinary accomplishment for this jury. It was a compromise verdict in the final analysis because they said we were guilty of conspiracy. But it seems that the conspiracy, and this is what we're trying to figure out, the conspiracy, and we are challenging that. We are going to court to challenge that. But it seems like the conspiracy was to work for the Russians. But the jury said we didn't work for the Russians, and which was an important determination, especially, you know, some friends of ours, our mutual friends, they were there for this trial. And this jury got an extraordinary political education over a short period of time. And they heard one of our lawyers in this opening statement stand up and throw his fist in the air. Go, Uhuru, 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 said, this is Swahili for freedom. It means freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of association. You're going to be hearing a lot of that during this whole process. So then you heard one of the lawyers, point to me and say, during this may have been a closing argument, that Chairman Amali Shetela cannot be bought. He does not work for the Russians. He is a revolutionary, a man of high principles and things like that. This is being said in the courtroom. We had a situation where one of the lawyers, the only witnesses that the state brought were people that they pay. Mm-hmm. 12 FBI agents, two so-called expert witnesses, one of whom could not even tell the jury how much money he's being paid to be an expert to put us in prison. Mm. Both of whom had to testify they knew nothing about the case at all, nothing about the case. They had no information on the case. And then the lead FBI investigator having to say that there's nothing that they saw that indicated that we tried to impact work for the Russians to involve in any kind of elections or anything like that to move the elections up in the favor, you know, to anything like that. And that there was anything that they saw of us, and they had everything from us, minutes from our central committee meetings to videos of me speaking in Moscow and things. They said they saw nothing in that entire process that was different from the things that they saw we have been doing for the last 50 years. Nothing, they said. So this whole notion about, you know, we being on a path that was charted by the Russians was just absolutely trashed. Right. And we had extraordinary lawyers. I mean, the lawyers were incredible human beings. Mutaki Akbar, you may know his father, Naeem Akbar, who's relatively well known, and Addie Griffin, who was my lawyer personally, although it was the group defense. And there was Leonard Goodman, who was formerly Penny Hess's attorney, and his assistant, Angela Rainey. Tom Inskeep was one of the lawyers. We had just a battery of extraordinary lawyers and courageous lawyers. Yes. And the thing that was so important, Marcia, is you, and I mean this, I'm not, you know, this is a literal truth, because that courthouse was full. We asked them for the largest courtroom they had, they gave it to us. And the judge, you know, in doing it, you know, made the comment that he knew that, you know, the first day, going to be a lot of people there, but the next day it's not going to be like that. And every day the courtroom was filled. Mm-hmm. And when that jury looked out at who was in the courtroom, they saw people who looked just like them. They didn't see anybody who one would say that looks like a Russian agent there. They saw people who were just like them. They saw Latinos. You know, they saw white people, they saw Africans, they saw, young people, old people, just an array of people out there. And they saw and they saw all of that. So that was really important. And it was a real powerful thing that happened in that short period of time. And so we got this mixed verdict as it's characterized. And this is due in part to the fact that The fact that the prosecution has the last in closing arguments, the prosecution is last. And the prosecution can and did lie with the closing arguments, and we don't have an opportunity to come back before the jury and say, nope, that didn't happen. What they said is a lie. That's untrue. It's factually untrue. You know, we couldn't say that. But you know, our lawyers have gone saying that you can't allow them to do this Russia thing. This is what they're trying to do all along. So it was an extraordinary victory, and the jury got an extraordinary political education. It was very powerful.
So there's a mixed decision, and so you win on the fact that you're not a Russian agent, but the jury splits the decision in terms of conspiracy.
Yes.
So and that's what you're facing right now is the conspiracy charges.
We're convicted on that. We're facing sentencing. On November 25th, we go back to Tampa to be sentenced. And we could be sentenced up to 5 years in prison on that charge. And, you know, we're calling on people again to be in Tampa. A part of what we're doing is in anticipation of that, we have to go through this pretrial kind of investigation. So in theory, they investigate our lives and, you know, our history of truth and veracity, et cetera, to make some kind of decision. And we think that the people's, there are things that we're asking people to do around that, but coming to that trial, I think is real testimony about our character as well.
Okay, so what date is that trial?
The sentencing is November 25th.
And you would like for people to be in Tampa for that event?
Right. That's right. And if you missed the first one, you got a chance to do it again.
And we want to thank our sister, Lucy Murphy, for
joining
all of us at the trial. So thank you so much. We didn't get a chance to talk about the $10 million bounty. We wanted to talk about how the U.S. government placed a $10 million bounty basically on your heads by offering money to anyone who would come forward with information. And they still left the court with their $10 million in their pockets because no one came forward. So we're grateful for that. Now you have two upcoming events and we only have a minute left. So November 2nd, Washington, D.C. We're
off in
Washington, D.C. to tell us what happens.
Yeah, Washington, D.C. is extremely important. This will be the 16th annual mobilization of the Black is Black Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations, the Black People's March on the White House. In this instance, we're really building it as an anti-colonial free speech mobilization in defense of the Uhuru 3, this sentencing that's coming, to rally people to Tampa, Florida, but also to have colonized people, Palestinians, Mexicans, Africans, Filipinos, et cetera, you know, they're leading this mobilization, what have you. And so that's going to be critically significant. So that's on the 2nd. And go to handsoffuhuru.org to get more information about that. Go to blackisbackcoalition.org to get information about that. Yes.
Thank you. And then on November 25th, of course, you'd like for us to be in Tampa.
That's right.
In the courtroom.
Let's make them get a bigger courtroom again.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, as you know, Chairman O'Malley, you are my hero. I mean, I want to be like you when I grow up. And I love the pushback. I love the fight. I love the revolutionary, not only spirit, but action that you bring to the table each and every minute of your day. So thank you so much for everything you're doing for our community. I'd love to have you come back maybe in October to talk about these two actions. In November, but we want to congratulate you and the entire community for the battle and the struggle that you put up against the U.S. government. Please let us know how we can be of assistance and what we can do.
Thank you, Sister Marsha. Thank your listeners and here PFW as well as I think BAI, the whole Pacifica Network, because you played an important role in bringing Pacifica into this process. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Uh-huh. Thank you. Uhuru. Thank you so much. I'd like to thank all of our guests, attorney Steve Lieberman and Chairman Omalia Satella. I'd like to thank executive producer Ms. Verna Avery Brown. This program was engineered by Mr. Michael Nasella. We are celebrating the 21st anniversary of the passage of the No Fear Act, the first civil rights and whistleblower law of the 21st century. WPFW salutes whistleblowers.
Hi, this is Miyuki Williams.
And I'm Robin Holden. This is Reggae Music and the Reggae Experience present a WPFW fundraising concert featuring Image Band, Curlew Reggae All-Stars Band, Lady Flame, and Carl Malcolm.
On Saturday, October 5th, 7 p.m. until midnight at King Solomon Lodge, 2245 Rhode Island Avenue Northeast.
Tickets available at Eventbrite by searching WPFW.
All proceeds to benefit WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The talk show Africa Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available from iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Jazz musician Herbie Hancock and his band, featuring Terrence Blanchard, grace the stage of the Warner Theater on Friday, September 27th. Info available at warnertheater.com.
No social justice issue or movement can escape the spotlight of the Latino Media Collective. The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW, Washington.
Hi, this is Tom Cole, host of G-Strings, here on WPFW every Sunday morning. I and the rest of the station's volunteers and staff would like to invite you to join the WPFW Legacy Listener Circle by making a contribution to the station's future through your estate plan. There are a lot of ways to do that, through your IRA or retirement plan, by gifting us life insurance, or through your donor-advised fund. We'd be happy to have a confidential discussion with you as you consider a planned gift to the station. Please reach out to us at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or call us at 202-588-0999. Thank you for considering becoming a part of WPFW's future.
This is Rev Yearwood, and I am so excited to announce our new climate show, Think 100% Climate Friday. This show will keep you up to date on everything climate justice related in a rapidly changing world. We will discuss breaking news and updates on environmental issues, the climate crisis, COVID-19, and politics. This show will make tangible how the climate crisis is already impacting our lives and what you can do about it. So tune in every Friday at 9 o'clock a.m. right here on WPFW 89.3, your jazz and justice station.
Attention jazz and creative music fans. On Friday, September 27th, New York meets DC when pianist Matthew Shipp's trio performs on a double bill with Washington's own pianist and bandleader Janelle Gill and her trio at the NYU campus in downtown DC.